quorum this afternoon, but that's okay because we're going to start with public hearing. And I want to do that, move right into a public hearing on Senate Bill 318. So I will open that and call up, I've got Maureen McKnight, Rita Perry, and Gina McLeod. Why don't you all come on up together? And while they're coming up, I'll open that public hearing and counsel if you'd give us the background.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll do some background. Both at one time, both the bills we're hearing today, Senate Bill 318 and 319, are both products of the Governor's Task Force on Domestic Violence. Roughly, Senate Bill 318 addresses certain technical issues which have arisen regarding the Family Abuse Prevention Act, a copy of which is before the members, and there are certain technical fixes and improvements which are sought by the bill which would address the issues of state-to-state enforcement, also handgun permits, and also would incorporate some provisions relating to stalking protective orders. There's also a dash A5 amendment, which is from the sponsors as well. Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Who wants to go first? Ms. McKnight.
Thank you. Chair Shetley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Maureen McKnight. I'm a member of the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence, which developed most of this bill, as Aaron Felton indicated. The other portion was developed by a work group that the interim House Judiciary convened to deal with changes in Oregon law necessitated by the Federal Violence Against Women Act. I want to preface my testimony with a clear statement on what this bill does not do. It does not create any new offenses involving domestic violence. It does not expand the gun dispossession provisions of the federal statutes for individuals who are charged or convicted of domestic violence. And it does not create a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, conviction for which under the federal law would result in a lifelong ban in possessing firearms. What the bill does is make Oregon's law conform to the federal law insofar as individuals who are already prohibited by federal law from possessing firearms are concerned. And it's a temporary disability. It lasts only so long as that individual is subject to a restraining order or a stalking order that meets federal standards. So what we're doing with this bill is adding the technical changes to Oregon's Family Abuse Prevention Act and to its stalking laws so that the kinds of orders that we have mesh with the findings and the requirements of the federal law for individuals who are have those orders issued against them. The bill also creates a procedure whereby a restraining order is reviewed automatically by the court after 30 days if the respondent hasn't requested a hearing. And this is to comply with the requirement in the federal statute that in order to be subject to these enforcement remedies in federal court, the restraining order has to have been issued after a hearing at which the respondent actually got notice and could participate. Oregon's model right now is one in which most orders, in fact, almost all orders are issued ex parte with just the petitioner, the person who's claiming abuse, going in, and a hearing happens only if the respondent requests it. And those hearings happen really only in about a quarter of cases. So we've created a procedure whereby we do have an actual hearing. It's a continuation hearing, and the respondent receives actual notice of that. The bill is quite lengthy and detailed. The second page of my testimony lists in bullet form virtually all of the changes, and they run from making sure that the sheriff provides the petitioner with true copies of the proof of service, requiring the sheriff to cooperate with law enforcement agencies in other states who want information about stalking or restraining orders in Oregon, has removal provisions to make sure stalking orders get out of our law enforcement data systems when they terminate, requires that stalking orders contain the kind of findings that the federal law requires if there is to be this type of federal prosecution for possession while the order is in effect. There are also provisions that deal with concealed handgun licenses, amending that process to conform to the federal statute as well. Current law allows the issuance of a permit to an individual charged with subject to a restraining order, but would allow revocation of the permit if the restraining order or stalking order were violated. The amendment right now, the minute that's proposed here, rather, would make anyone who is currently subject to a restraining order or stalking order ineligible to apply for a license and also have that issue, the pendency of that order be grounds to revoke it, again, to conform to the federal statute that while you're subject to a restraining or stalking order, you are dispossessed as a matter of federal law, that is a federal liability for being in possession of a handgun, a temporary disability. There's also a provision that would prohibit the sheriff from charging fees to serve foreign restraining orders, and this is a requirement of federal law if we are to receive any federal money under the Violence Against Women Act. And Oregon now gets approximately $2 million on one major program that goes to local communities to fund shelters and also fund specific programs at district attorney's offices and law enforcement agencies. The bill also amends the Family Abuse Prevention Act forms, as I said, with having the kinds of findings required by federal law. And I think probably most importantly, it greatly expands the kind of notice that a respondent in a restraining order case receives about all the liability that that respondent could face under federal law during the time that that restraining order is in effect if that respondent possesses a firearm. And it also lists all the other new federal crimes that might potentially apply to an individual in regards to interstate travel involving domestic violence or stalking. So we've greatly expanded that. The stalking forms, as I said, have also been changed, and the standard of proof is clarified as a preponderance of the evidence for Elder Abuse Prevention Act cases. This conforms to an amendment that is in another bill you'll hear today. There are some amendments to this bill that are proposed by the Family Law Bench in Multnomah County. You have attached to my testimony a letter from Judge Harrell of that court. And those amendments would would change the word immediate and present danger in the Family Abuse Prevention Act to imminent. To get a restraining order under our statutes, you have to show essentially two things in addition to being in a defined relationship with the respondent. You have to show that there's been abuse within the last 6 months, and you have to show that you're in immediate and present danger of further abuse. And there are many judges, including the Multnomah County bench, that are concerned, that that immediate and present danger standard is too harsh and that it prevents the issuance of restraining orders when an individual has been threatened by someone who might be in another town or might be incarcerated, and that individual it plans to travel to or to come to the victim, but that person is not in the immediate vicinity and not immediately accessible to the victim. The judge's belief is that changing that to imminent would be more in keeping with what other states are doing and also provide better protection for the survivors that come before them. The other change is to delete the word serious from the definition of abuse that is based on fear. Again, to get a restraining order, I said you had to show abuse, and right now immediate and present danger of further abuse. And the abuse part breaks down into injury or fear or forced sexual relations. And in that fear category, right now the law is that you would have to have intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly placed another in fear of imminent serious bodily injury. And again, the judges on the Family Law Bench in Portland are proposing that the word serious be deleted so that that standard of just imminent bodily injury is more in keeping with what would be Assault 3 and Assault 4s, the kind of conduct that would be charged that way, as opposed to serious bodily injury, which would involve the threat of death or protracted impairment of health or bodily organ, which is more akin to the higher felonies of Assault 3 and Assault 4. That is, the judges believe that the standard should reach the standard that you would have to show in order to get a restraining order would be akin to what are the commonly charged crimes in terms of Assault 4 and Assault 3. Those are the summaries, I guess, of a fairly comprehensive bill. The proponents on the council believe that this bill will make restraining orders and stalking orders more enforceable, and they'll also give better notice to respondents about the enhanced penalties that are now imposable under federal law And I, once you've heard from the other witnesses or whenever, I'm happy to answer any questions about the A engrossed or the dash fives. Thank you.
One question I would have about the dash five amendments, I think just I think you've made it clear, but I want to make sure that I understand. I know this bill was, first of all, introduced at the governor's request, but also as a product of a large work group that I sat in on over the interim. You're comfortable the dash five amendments are congruent with the interests that were represented in the work group as well as the governor's?
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, yes, I am. They have been brought to the attention specifically only of the legislative subcommittee of those work groups and not to the full, but none of those individuals had problems with them. I would be remiss, however, I neglected to clarify that on the dash five, on line 14, the reference to the various statutes, the three statutes at the end, 133.055, 133.10, and 133.15, those should be deleted. The words that are defined in subsequent sections, their abuse, child, family, household member, those do not appear in those criminal statutes. And we are attempting to define the word abuse only under the Family Abuse Prevention Act, which is ORS 107.700-732.
Okay.
The last four words on that line 14 should
so
not be.
The conceptual amendment would be to delete the line after 107.700, delete the rest of the words and statute numbers, but leave in the colon then.
It would be 107.700-732, comma.
Yeah.
Excuse me, the comma would become a colon, yes, and the rest of the line would be deleted.
There we go. Okay.
What page are you talking about?
Page one of the dash fives, excuse me, on line 14. So the reference would be as used in ORS 107.700 to 107.732, colon.
Okay. Representative Werbelow.
Actually, this is, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the proposed amendments, and I guess I didn't pick this up in the original bill, but I'm just curious, and I think this, sometimes when they do these amendments, you can't tell what's new law and what's old law. But I think this is old law, but in any case, when it's doing the definitions in 107.700 to 732, and it talks about abuse between family or household members, I just think it was rather curious that one of the definitions is people who have cohabited, who are or who have cohabited. If you have cohabited, you're not anymore, so that probably means you don't live in a household, which is the normal, you know, way of thinking if somebody lives in the same house. But you are including people even though they don't live in the same household, but who have cohabited with them before.
Chair Shetterly, Representative, you will allow, that is correct. This is, first of all, existing law. None of the amendments to session affect the relationships. And existing law has protected not only individuals who are currently in a sexually intimate relationship or within the last 2 years, which would be line 5 on page 2 of the dash 5, but on line 4, which you referred to, persons who are cohabiting or who have cohabited, and that past cohabitation is in the statute because of the fact we know what increased lethality and danger there is when individuals have separated and moved apart.
Mr. I'm not arguing it shouldn't be. I think it should be in there, but it's just when you look at it, it's confusing because the first, the overlying definition is in the household, and that, of course, is really not theoretically in the household, somebody should argue.
Representative Huberlot would, in essence, be a former household member if there had been cohabitation.
And I think there's a symmetry there because we have on line 2 of page 2 former spouses. So you have spouses, former spouses, and then cohabitants and people who have formerly cohabited. So I imagine the issues are probably the same both ways. That's interesting, too. Okay.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, my name is Gina McLard. I'm the staff attorney with the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 319 and the Dash 5 amendments. 318, I'm sorry. I represent the 29 member programs of the coalition, and each member of the committee does, in fact, have one at least one of our programs in their district. Senate Bill 318 is greatly needed for survivors of domestic violence. Survivors who have restraining orders against their abusers find themselves often unprotected when they have to flee out of state. This bill would help broaden the protection that they have. It gives tools to law enforcement. First of all, it would allow for restraining orders to be entered into the national database, the NCIC, but it also provide copies to the survivor so that when she does travel out of state, she can provide the most recent copy to the law enforcement so that he will know that, in fact, this is a true Oregon restraining order and be able to protect her according to Oregon law in his state. Beyond that, knowing that the order is entered into this nationwide system would provide survivors with some sense of relief, of course not total sense of relief, because in some cases we know that it's merely a piece of paper and that there is still further abuse that happens, but at least she has some ability to defend herself when law enforcement asks, is in fact this the most recent copy of your order? Survivors of domestic violence are at great risk when there are guns in the home. They're at great risk when their abusers continue to possess guns after they leave. We know that the most dangerous time, the most lethal time for battered women is when they attempt to get out of the relationship. FBI statistics in 1996 show us that 398 women were killed by their husbands, not including their intimate partners, but by their husbands in 1 year. That's more than one victim of domestic violence homicide every day. That's essential why we must pass Senate Bill 318. The link between being put into a very dangerous situation when you try to get out of a domestic violence situation and then dispossessing the batterer once there is a restraining order, a valid restraining order with proper notice requirements met, this will save the lives of Oregon women. This will save the lives of Oregon children, too. The Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence urges your support for Senate Bill 318. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the court? Okay. Ms. Perry?
Chair Shetterly and members of the committee. My name is Rita Perry. I'm a survivor of domestic violence and a resident of Marion County, City of Salem. I am in support of this bill also. My son, who is now 11, had a gun held to his head by his father, who is currently under a stalking order. At that time, had a restraining order. Held a gun to my son's head and threatened his life, the rest of our family's life, and his friend's life, that if he disclosed the sexual abuse, that he would murder all of us in front of him and kill him last. The domestic violence continues. He is out of the home. And it is very frightening to us. My children and I all suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder due to the violence that was in our home. And my 11-year-old son yesterday was discharged from Salem Hospital's adolescent psych unit due to the post-traumatic stress disorder escalating over another contact by the perpetrator. I ask that you would take this into consideration in protecting our children as well as our lives, women and men of domestic violence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perry. Questions for any of these witnesses? Okay. I just want to underscore, I think, what Maureen, what you said. I know guns are the subject du jour these days, but the emphasis in this bill that this bill does not expand the gun dispossession provisions that are already in federal law. It conforms Oregon law to what federal law already provides.
Sure, surely that's correct. Okay. It's not an expansion, it's an implementation of existing federal law.
Okay, let me close the public hearing on Senate Bill 318. I'm sorry, yeah, I'll do that. And open a work session. Committee, this has a referral to Ways and Means. There's a fiscal impact. You've got the fiscal impact statement in the file. So if it's the pleasure of the committee, we can move the amendment in and then move the bill out to Ways and Means. Representative Werbelow.
I move Are they dash five? The dash five?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, let's, I'm sorry, Representative. Chair request unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow conceptual amendments to the dash five amendments. Representative Werbelow? Do you want to move the conceptual amendments?
Conceptual amendments to the dash five amendments, right.
Representative Werbelow moves conceptual amendment to the dash, I'm sorry, is there any objection to the suspension of the rules? Okay, so ordered. Representative Werbelow moves a conceptual amendment to the dash A5 amendments, and again, as we heard, that would be to delete the comma after 107.732 on line 14 and delete the rest of the line to the colon, but leaving in the colon, so that line 14 would read 107.705 as used in ORS 107.700 to 107.732 colon. Is there any objection to the conceptual amendment to the dash A5s? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill...
I'm sorry, well, now we need the dash A5s in.
That's right.
Conceptually amended.
I'm trying to sort changes. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash A5 as conceptually amended.
Thank you. Representative Werbelow moves the dash A5s as conceptually amended into Senate Bill 318. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Okay.
Now to Ways and Means.
Now, I move Senate Bill 318 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
All right, thank you. Representative Werbelow moves Senate Bill 318 as amended to Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank the folks for coming forward today, particularly Ms. Perry. I appreciate that it's difficult to come and tell your story. That's my thank you.
Okay, please call the roll. Thank you.
Representative Bethlen?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Lowell?
Aye.
Representative Werbelow?
Yes.
Representative Walker?
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Yes.
Representative Witt?
Yes.
Chair Sutherland?
Yes. House Bill 3, Senate Bill 318 has amended and goes to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. We close the work session on Senate Bill 318 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 319. And I'll invite back up Ms. McKnight and Ms. McCord while Council gives us the overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Senate Bill 319 addresses some issues around the Family Abuse Prevention Act, a copy of which is before the committee. It's designed to give quick relief in abusive situations, which often occur in family law and other types of domestic relations situations, and it allows the court to do various things under that act. Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Welcome back.
Thank you. Chair Shadley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Maureen McKnight. I'm appearing again on behalf of the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence, which developed this bill. What 319 does is remedy several problems in Oregon's handling of domestic violence arrests and in its handling of restraining orders. The first issue and the highest priority this year for the Council in terms of its legislative agenda was to delete the language at the scene, which currently exists now in terms of the mandatory arrest statute. Under current law, a peace officer at the scene of a domestic disturbance is required to arrest an assailant or potential assailant when it's a domestic situation. That is certain defined categories. And through hearings we've held on the council throughout the state, we've been made aware that some law enforcement agencies have interpreted this at the scene language to refer to the party's presence at the scene, not to the officers. So in other words, if the officer arrives at the scene and the perpetrator is gone, or if the victim has fled the scene, some officers and some agencies are interpreting that statute to mean they don't have a duty to arrest, that the victim could still go down to the district attorney's office and make a complaint, but that there isn't a mandatory duty to arrest at that point, even if the victim has fled next door or the perpetrator's locale is known in the vicinity. And with the support of Sheriff Stan Robson and others who have trained law enforcement on this issue, The council has proposed the deletion of that at-the-scene requirement so that the language is replaced with when the officer responds to an incident of domestic violence. Two other changes in the bill affect domestic disturbances. The first is to make consistent the individuals who are protected by mandatory arrest there at the scene of a domestic disturbance, make those categories of individuals consistent with individuals who may petition for restraining orders under the Family Abuse Prevention Act, which categories of relationship we looked at just a minute ago under 318. Right now, there is an inconsistency in terms of what relationships are covered, in large part because as we've amended the Family Abuse Prevention Act, we haven't gone back each session and brought the mandatory arrest relationships up to date. So this second amendment would make sure that the same individuals who qualify for restraining orders are the same individuals who are entitled to the protection of a mandatory arrest at the scene of domestic disturbance. This bill also updates the notice that peace officers are required to leave at the scene of a domestic disturbance for victims to inform them of their legal remedies and community resources. The second major area that 319 addresses is the restraining order process. And probably the most significant amendment here is the codification of the standard of proof for proceedings under the Family Abuse Prevention Act. We've had this law in our books for over 20 years, and practitioners and judges have always assumed that the standard was a preponderance of the evidence, just more likely than not that this abuse had happened and that the danger occurred. There was a case that was decided by the Court of Appeals this past summer, Bolt v. Bolt, that in a one-sentence discussion of the issue while it went on to other facts in the case, said clear and convincing must be the standard since this is an injunction. This is not the standard, as I say, that has been used in practice. It's not the standard used in other states. And what this bill would do is codify what has historically been the practice and put the standard at preponderance of the evidence. Again, this is what the majority of states do in protective proceedings. There are several other changes to the Act. We would be adding protection to a survivor who moves from her current residence, that is a petitioner who asks for a restraining order and specifies provisions that he or she is asking the judge to restrain the respondent from entering, often now puts her current address in, even though that specific address isn't required and just language that says her home is required. And the problem that has come up is if she moves from that address, there are some police officers who will not arrest if he comes to her new house because the restraining order doesn't say the new house, it said house, and she happened to put an old address on it. So we're adding the subsequently acquired residence to it. It also clarifies that emergency monetary relief could be ordered. Last, in 1995, the legislature added relief that the court could order any relief the court found necessary to provide for the safety and welfare of the petitioner and her children. That is relief that the court could individually fashion to protect a particular individual. And we have been able to obtain for petitioners in this situation things like temporary use of the car, and it's only been very rarely that we have been able to have a judge order temporary relief in terms of monetary assistance. And we're not talking child support, we are not talking ongoing maintenance, we're talking about things like security deposits, first month rent, repair of a damaged window, the kind of emergency one-time assistance that will enable the petitioner or her children to remain safe. And again, that would be a requirement under the statute, under the existing law, that the court would have to find that that emergency monetary relief was necessary for the safety of the petitioner or the petitioner's children. The last thing that, I shouldn't say the last thing, but also in the restraining order process, we've clarified authority for the court to order no contact between the parties. There's a common misconception that a restraining order is actually a no-contact order. And it is not a no-contact order unless that particular provision is checked and the kind of contact that's prohibited is clarified. This would clear up that confusion and create both the forms and the substantive authority for no contact to be an option. And again, this is subject to contact or communications that are necessary to arrange for parenting time. The parenting time provisions in a restraining order, the statutory forms, indicate that contact necessary to arrange for the child is defined in the order is not otherwise prohibited by the restraining order. Also, in the restraining order process, sheriffs would be required to ask respondents for their birth date if that did not appear on the documents, because we cannot get restraining orders into the either the Oregon law enforcement data system or into the National Protective Order Registry if we don't have birth dates. And procedures at contested hearings about restraining orders are clarified. I've mentioned, I believe, in earlier testimony that the process is the petitioner requests an order on an ex parte basis. That is, it's just her, usually her going in, giving her testimony. The respondent then receives a copy of it. He's served often by the sheriff, and if the respondent wants a hearing, he has 30 days to request that, and there's a time frame for how soon that hearing has to be held. This bill would clarify that the court can order at that hearing anything that the court could have granted at the ex parte level, whether or not it was requested. And that if that kind of request is made, the respondent has a set-over right equivalent to what the petitioner has in other circumstances. We've tried to equate those things. The last thing deals with just one of the gun provisions insofar as release agreements in criminal court for defendants charged with domestic violence crimes. We've talked about how the federal law has requirements for findings and other protections if an individual in a criminal or a civil court is subject to a restraining, a stalking order, a no contact order. And this last issue just addresses, and it would be a few because there would have to be notice and hearing first, of a bail or recog agreement in a domestic violence criminal case where the defendant was released on the condition that he not have contact with or harass or stalk the victim. That same kind of order is subjects the respondent to the same federal penalties for possessing a firearm during the life of that order. I believe there are some -1 amendments I don't have in front of me, but these are certainly with the agreement of the proponents and requested by Senator Q-Tub on the Senate side, just to make sure we had incorporated the definition of family and household member from the Family Abuse Prevention Act and put that into the mandatory arrest provisions in Chapter 133. And that is what the -1 amendments do. So if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer.
So the -1 amendments, it appears to be the same amendment that we just conceptually did in 318.
The section, Chair Shuttle, Section 6 on line 5 does delete those last three references. Yes, I'm looking to see whether it also, it did not make the deletion on line 13 of serious, though. So if you recall, in Senate Bill 318, the -5s, I believe, not only deleted the word serious in line 13, but they failed to do what this -1 did that I apologize I had not seen before today. They do make the same deletion. What we've done in 318 and 319-1 are not inconsistent, but apparently the conceptual amendment in 318 was not necessary if the -1s in 319 go.
So are the -1s in 319 necessary now that we've done the conceptual amendment in 318?
The -1s in Chair Shuttle, the -1s in 319-1 are necessary because lines 1 through 4 insert the definitions from 107-705 from the Family Abuse Prevention Act into the mandatory arrest statute, and the other bill did not do that. What in lines 5 and following on the -1s in 319, what this amendment does is not, lines 5 and following are not necessary in light of the -5 amendments, including the conceptual amendment done on 318.
Lines 1 through 4, no, I'm sorry, lines 1 through 1, 2, and 3 are what go into the mandatory arrest provisions.
Chair Shelley, that's correct. It would be lines 4 and following that are not needed in light of the dash 5, including the conceptual amendment on Senate Bill 318.
My inclination when we get to work session would be to conceptually amend these, just to delete lines 4 through 24 on page 1 and then delete page 2, just so we don't. I think that, to me, that seems cleaner. And that just leaves lines 1, 2, and 3 as the amendment to this bill. Is that agreeable to you?
Chair Shelley, that's fine. Thank you.
Did you want to testify?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Chair Shelley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gina McLard, and I'm here representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. My comments will be brief, but I just wanted to give some everyday examples of why Senate Bill 319 is so important to survivors of domestic violence. The first essential point is the changes to the mandatory arrest statute, so that if a law enforcement officer comes to a 911 call and the perpetrator is not at the scene, that currently under Oregon law, as it's being interpreted, the perpetrator would not be arrested at that time. This is very problematic for battered women for two reasons. First of all, the batterer is very likely going to be very angry that she called the police. So unless he's immediately removed from the premises, she will suffer, most likely suffer, further abuse at the hands of the batterer. Secondly, batterers consistently tell their victims that no one's going to believe them, that the system's not going to be there for them, that they're going to think that if they report the abuse that she's lying. So if the police do come to the scene and cannot make the arrest, then those beliefs are going to be solidified in her mind. Unfortunately, the result of that we often see is that the next time that she is abused, she's less likely to call 911 and seek law enforcement assistance. Senate Bill 319 would also allow, just as Maureen pointed out, a judge to order emergency monetary assistance. And this is very important. In my job, I receive calls from advocates in the shelters and directly from battered women asking me different elements of their case and how we can help them. They often ask for money, and unfortunately, the shelters do not have a whole lot of petty cash to be able to provide every victim with the needs that she has. So this is extremely important. This could make the difference between a victim who has to leave the apartment that she shared with the batterer from becoming homeless in hopes that this emergency monetary assistance would allow her to get an apartment of her own. We had one case where the money from an emergency monetary order would allow her to get a bus ticket to her parents' home. 319 also codifies the standard of evidence as a preponderance, as Maureen has mentioned. This is very important. Practically what we're seeing since the Bolt v. Bolt case that came down this summer is that we are seeing judges, unfortunately, are finding themselves in the position to require higher levels of abuse than we have ever required by practice in Oregon for a restraining order. We have heard from different places throughout Oregon that clear and convincing, this level of proof is the judges are looking for broken bones and for visible bruises. And it is, I believe, public policy in Oregon that for long-standing practice, we have not required such extreme levels and life-threatening levels of proof for one to obtain a restraining order. We also have another problem with the new standard of proof in that judges now feel that they can't hold the telephone hearings for an ex parte hearing that they have been holding because of the new level. They feel that they must see the victim in front of them in order to be able to grant the order. Oftentimes this is very problematic because the victim has gone into hiding or for travel distances, and especially in Eastern Oregon, she cannot make it, and that she has relied on the shelter to be able to provide the telephone assistance to the judge. So codifying a preponderance would help battered women greatly in Oregon. The coalition urges your support on Senate Bill 319, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Bouchard, I took you off the list.
Okay.
You're off the list. Okay. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 319 then? Okay. Let's close the public hearing on that. And again, we have the dash one amendments before us with conceptual amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments. I move the conceptual amendment to suspend the, oh gosh, yeah.
Representative Werbelow moves to suspend the rules to allow conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 319. Is there any objection? It's ordered.
It's lucky I'm not the parliamentarian.
Representative Werbelow.
Yes, I move the conceptual amendments to the dash one amendments, which is eliminating the existing line four through the end of page one and then also page two.
Representative Werbelow moves the conceptual amendment to the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 319 by deleting lines 4 through 24 on the first page and deleting page 2 entirely. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Werbelow.
Where am I now? Okay. I move the dash one amendments as conceptually amended.
Representative Werbelow moves the dash one amendments as conceptually amended in the Senate Bill 319. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any objection? So ordered. Again? Representative Werbelow.
I move the Senate Bill 319 as amended to, this doesn't have to go to Ways and Means,
no.
Right, to the floor with a due
process. Thank you. Representative Werbelow moves Senate Bill 319 as amended, including the conceptual amendment, to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Finally, another country heard from. I would like to thank very much the bringers of this marvelous piece of legislation, and I want to thank them for their hard work. This has long been needed, and I'm very excited about it.
I appreciate that, and I want to say, too, as one who sat in on a number of the interim work groups, not so much on 319, but 318, but dealing with these things together, that was a great work group, folks representing all sorts of interests and a lot of meetings. This was not something that was put together in a short order. And so I think, again, a good product by a hard-working group, and I want to thank Ms. McKnight and the rest of her cohorts for the work in putting this together.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to add that that's why I was interested in moving the bill, because I was also a member of that work group with you, and there was a lot of good coming together of people and working on this, and they're very valuable bills.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Chair Shetterly. There's no opponents signed up for this. We have this thing from the Oregon Men's Association, and that's been withdrawn.
And it's entered for the record, but nobody has signed up. Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse?
Representative Lowell?
Aye.
Representative Werbelow?
Yes.
Representative Walker?
Aye, aye.
Representative
Lowell?
Yes. Representative
Williams?
Yes.
Representative
Witt? Aye. Chair Shetterly?
Aye. Senate Bill 319 as amended goes to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Carrier?
I think Representative Werbelow was asking if she could.
I think that sounds like a good idea. You remember the work group? Representative Werbelow it is.
But if she didn't want to, I was going to volunteer.
I didn't want to carry it.
With that, I believe we have concluded our work for the day.
Wow.
Thank you, everybody.
Larry, well done. You've been late.
Adjourn.
Almost asleep.